So do you ever feel like no one's listening to you? One of my professors at ACU, he talked about speaking in chapel. And he said, chapel at ACU is quite a unique experience. He says, never will you experience in your life 1,000 people all ignoring you at the same time. That's pretty good. You may have heard the story of one of our presidents. I was going to say the number, and now I can't remember which president he was. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He endured a lot of long receiving lines. They would have these state dinners. He served 4 terms as president. And he would be in these receiving lines, and he always hated small talk, and he noticed that no one really ever listened to him. He said nobody really paid attention while they were greeting each other and what he said. And so one day during a reception, he decided to try a little experiment. And as he greeted each head of state that came down the line, he would shake their hand, lean over, and whisper to them, "I murdered my grandmother this morning." And the guests responded with phrases like, "Marvelous! Keep up the good work! We are so proud of you. God bless you, sir." And it wasn't until the very end of the line when the ambassador from Bolivia, heard his words. You can imagine, being bilingual, it really struck him. And the ambassador just leaned back over to the president and said, "I'm sure she had it coming." It's tough, right? It's tough when you feel like nobody's listening. Parents, this is what we complain about the most. You heard me, but you didn't listen, because if you'd listen, you would do what I say. But it's a frustrating thing to feel like you're talking and nobody's really listening. So I'm just curious, just for the ladies of the congregation, you guys look at me every week, and do you ever go home and think, "I should call Jeff for fashion advice? Like, I was thinking about buying this new dress, but Jeff is so fashion forward in the way that he dresses. I bet he has great opinion." See, none of you have ever thought of doing that. And yet, there is one of you that does. She's sitting back there already shaking her head, and she often gets dressed in the morning, and she comes to me and she says, "Now, what do you think?" And she'll put one shoe on and a different shoe on, and it's a test. And she'll say, "Which pair of shoes do you think I should wear? Which one looks best?" And I think, I'm not qualified to make this decision. Woman, why do you involve me in this? And so one time, you ever have your brain or your mouth move a little faster than your brain? Again, you couldn't catch up that morning. And I said to her, I said, "Honey, baby, love you. But you don't really want my opinion. You want your opinion in my voice." And that was the time she chose to listen to me, right? Other times that might have just gone right by. But the frustrating thing was, because often I would give my opinion, and then what would she do? She would do whatever she was going to do before. And I thought, why are you even listening to me on this? I'm not qualified. I'm not checked out on the equipment. I have nothing. I said, do you ever just think Jeff just looks so well put together that he ought to speak into my dress? No, you don't think that. We're talking this morning about Mark. I got work to do when I get home. I know. Pray for me. It's fine. She love you. We're in Mark chapter 9, and I hope you've been reading with us this week. We send out, we're walking right through the Gospel of Mark chapter for chapter. So next week will be chapter 10. Surprise, surprise. But hopefully you've been reading this and looking into this. And this morning we're going to hear just a section. We're going to look at verses 1 through 13. And I want you to listen for the listen to. Here we go. "And he said to them, 'Truly I tell you, some of you who are standing here will not taste death before they see that the kingdom of God has come with power.' After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, 'Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah.' He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud, 'This is my son whom I love. Listen to him.' Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, why did the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? Jesus replied, to be sure Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him. Well, here in Mark chapter 9, we're finally getting the answer to the question that's been asked in every chapter leading up to this. And if you've been tracking with us, if you've been listening real carefully, Mark is posing this question, who is Jesus? And I know it started oddly, right? With that first verse, it seems like it doesn't really belong with the story this morning. And I intentionally did that because it makes you go, wait, Jeff, there's something else that's going on here. And the other part of the story is found in chapter 8. And he says to his disciples, it's in 8:29, he says, what about you? He asked, who do you say that I am? And boy, they've missed it, haven't they? I mean, every chapter, it seems like someone has missed the point of who Jesus is. Last week in chapter 8, it was that yeast of the Pharisees, their hard, purified hearts, or excuse me, petrified hearts that Jesus warned his disciples against. It was that yeast that says, although they heard Jesus, they did not listen to him. Or in chapter 7, that great question in verse 18 that Jesus asked his disciples, are you so dull? Do you not see that nothing that enters a man from the outside can defile them? Jesus describes people in chapter 7, in verse 6, he says, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. Jesus says, you've heard it, but you're not putting it into practice. Backing up another chapter, chapter 6, King Herod is the one who asks the question about Jesus. And in verse 14, King Herod heard about Jesus and how he'd become well known, and that you know, news is spreading about him throughout. And it says in verse 14, some were saying John the Baptist has been raised from the dead, and that is why miraculous powers are at work with him. Others say he's Elijah. Now you remember that was also a possibility that the disciples list in chapter 8. And still other claims he's a prophet, like one of the prophets of long ago. But when Herod heard this, he said, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised from the dead. Herod misses it too, doesn't he? Not just the Pharisees, it's not just the kings, it's also the disciples who don't get it. It's strange who does get it in the gospel account of Mark. In chapter 5, you have this great story of the man who's possessed not just by one demon, but thousands of demons. And when he sees Jesus, he shouts at the top of his voice, what do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High? The demon-possessed guy, he gets it right. In chapter 4, in verse 11, Jesus tells him, the secret of the kingdom of God has been given to you, but to those on the outside, everything's said in parables. It was when we were talking about that parable of the sower. And he says, the reason we do that is so that they may be ever seeing but never perceiving and ever hearing but never understanding. Otherwise, they might turn and be forgiven. Jesus wants to clear this up, it seems, once and for all. And in chapter 8, he doesn't just ask the disciples, who do people say that I am? But he asks that very, very pointed question, who do you say that I am? And then he talks about how the Son of Man must suffer. And Peter, who still doesn't get the clear picture, says, never, Lord. And then Jesus, in a really bold way, says to him, get behind me, Satan. You don't have in mind the things of God, but the things of man. You don't get the clear picture. And if anybody should have gotten it, it should have been those that followed him the closest. You remember, I guess it's been a year since we talked about that word disciple, what it means to follow Jesus. A disciple was one who would tether themselves to a rabbi, that would follow them around, not just listen to their sermons and take notes and be able to regurgitate the information about, but they would so closely follow their rabbi that in the writings it was said that may the dust of your rabbi be upon you. May you follow them so closely that they kick up their dust on you, and the things that they do, you do. There's a heaviness to following Jesus. You read this story, and it's not just all light and goodness and a wonderful, what we might call a mountaintop experience. where we sing Kumbaya and we hold hands with a cute girl and we just think, oh, God is so good. There's a heaviness to this. It's not recorded in Mark's account, but in Matthew's account it is in chapter 17. In Matthew 17, it says, when the disciples heard this, they fell down to the ground. That's worship, by the way. But then what? Terrified. Terrified. When's the last time we've been terrified of God? And it says in verse 7, but Jesus came and touched them. There's the part that's not recorded. We don't get it in Mark. We don't get it in Luke either. But Jesus touches them. And he touches them and he says, get up. Do not be afraid. And when they looked up, they saw no one but Jesus. So in other denominations, they follow what's called the liturgical calendar. I don't know if you know this, but they preach the same texts each week. And so if you're part of one of those fellowships, when you have preaching buddies, you can often pass back and forth, a sermon on Epiphany or a sermon for the second week of Lent. And there's because they know that the text is going to be the same. And I read this week some people that were talking about their sermons for the Transfiguration. The Transfiguration hits a certain week each year. And one preacher said to the other, he says, you know that Transfiguration sermon where it exhorts us to appreciate being on the mountaintop with God and the beauty, even if it's just for a minute, then we just feel that transcendence of His presence. You know that sermon that we preach, how great it is to be in the presence of God, and that then we have to descend from the mountaintop down to the valleys and take that with us. He said, yeah, I can't preach that sermon this year. Because for that particular preacher, it had all been valleys. Suffering from depression, suffering from a church that was coming apart at the hinges, suffering along with other people who were suffering, that sermon just didn't make much sense. And so he contacted a friend of his and he said, could we just talk about what we might preach out of the Transfiguration passage? And his friend responded with that idea of that Matthew passage, that Jesus touches his disciples. His friend reminded him of that it's in difficult times, and I love this phrase, he said, it's then that we need God with hands, not just God with words. And the preacher responded, I like your point about how Jesus touched them and they were terrified. I was just reading that Hebrew word for glory, kabod, means weight or heaviness. This speaks to the gravitas of Moses' experience with God on the mountain, and perhaps also the gravitas of the Christian life, that we're called not just to be prosperous and happy, but also to bear the cross, whatever that means. Maybe this means that when Jesus touches us, it's a heavy touch. It acknowledges that the suffering and sin intrinsic to the human condition, and yet, it's at the same time a healing touch, not just a heavy touch, but a healing touch. Lets us know that we're not alone in the human condition, but God is also in it with us, helping bear the heaviness. And then he concludes by saying this, I think that's the sermon I need to hear this year. Not that there's two distinct types of moments in our life, glory and suffering, but that we're called to immerse ourselves in the suffering for the sake of building up a later glory. That through Christ, we're bound up into this relationship with God who's present with us in the glory and the suffering. And the glory and the suffering are intertwined. There is no on the mountain and off the mountain. There's no mountaintop and valley. There's just the hours and the days and the years that we've been given. But they're filled with grace despite all of our limitations. Isn't that great? The touch of Jesus is a heavy touch that says, I understand the suffering. I'm going to go through the suffering. It's the suffering that was what got Peter all mixed up, right? When Jesus started talking about glory and power and kingdom and Messiah, yes, Lord. When Jesus says he's going to have to suffer and die and be delivered in the hands of evil men, Peter said no. And so some of us know what it's like for our lives to be only valleys and no peaks. And in the middle of that kind of holy terror, what do you need to hear? Maybe you need to hear this phrase from verse 7 of Mark 9. This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him. And when they heard those words, I think they heard the echoes of the Shema, that prayer that they prayed every morning, that prayer that we find in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit down at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. Shema Yisrael, Adonai, Eloheinu, Adonai, Adonai Echad. Just a few short words. Shema, listen or hear, accept, respond. Israel, that's the sense of the congregation, of the collective, of the country, of the chosen. In Texan, it's all y'all. That's what it is. It's all y'all. He says, all of y'all, listen. All of God's people should hear this. Adonai, that's often translated as Lord, but it's read in the place of the name Yahweh. And then he says here, Eloheinu, which is the plural first person possessive. He's saying he's our God. He's ours. He's yours. He's all of ours. He belongs to us. And then that great word, Echad, it's the unified and cardinal number one. There are no other gods. That doesn't sound too groundbreaking to us. Well, duh, there's only one God. But when we worship God, it should remind us that we have a lot of other choices for who and what we worship. David Foster Wallace, he once gave a commencement address. I did a commencement address last week, and now we're doing it again this week. But he spoke about the futility of following counterfeit false gods. And this is what he wrote. He said, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. Everybody worships. And pretty much anything you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, then you'll never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you in the ground. Worship power, you will feel weak and afraid, and you will never ever, and you will need ever more power over others to keep that fear at bay. And if you think about it, Mark writes into a context of this plurality of gods, right? There's an altar of Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty, and there's a temple of Artemis, the goddess of wealth. And today we still go to those temples. They go by different names. They're just in other forms. We still worship beauty. We still elevate wealth. Everybody worships. And pretty much anything you worship other than God will eat you alive. That's why we needed to come here this morning. Do you realize that? God didn't need you to show up. God understood that you coming together as his congregation, as Israel, was important. Because we need to sing together about God and to God. We need to listen to the words that are from God in his holy scriptures. We need to pray to God. We need to gather around the table of God. We're able to see with renewed clarity this morning how dangerous it is when our priorities get out of order. And by the way, we're also going to experience just how delightful and good our God is. Corporate worship helps us leave behind our counterfeit gods. I've told you this story before, but I want you to hear it again. It's from a book called The Source by James Michener. And he tells the story of Herbal, who was a farmer that lived in 2,200 years before Christ. And he worshipped two gods, and one was the god of death, And the other was the goddess of fertility. And so one day, the temple priests come to Erbal, and they ask him to bring his young son to the temple for sacrifice. That, I'm not talking about to bring a sacrifice, but his young son would be the sacrifice. Since this is the only thing that God will accept if he wants to have good crops this year. And so Erbal obeys, and on the appointed day, he drags his wife and his boy to the scene of his boy's religious execution by fire. And after the sacrifice of Erbal's boy, the priests and several others, the priests announce that one of the fathers will then have to spend the next week in the temple with a temple prostitute. And Erbal's wife is stunned as she notices a desire, he says, written more intensely across his face than she had ever seen before. And she's overwhelmed to see him eagerly lunge forward when his name is called. The ceremony over, she walks over to the temple with her head swimming, concluding, and hear this, church, if he had different gods, he would have been a different man. Listen to him. Listen to him again this morning, to the one who claims his son. This is my son whom I love. Listen to him. Hear, congregation, hear, gathered people, hear, all y'all, the great and powerful Creator God is our God. He is ours. He possesses us. And he is the only one we are to worship. And you say, Jeff, I get all that. I agree with all that. All that sounds good. But what should I do with that? Well, I'll give you a way to apply this through one last story. Sir Edmund Hillary, first person to ever climb Mount Everest. And the guy that went with him, his name was? Nobody knows the name of his Sherpa. You got it, John? Oh, yes! Some of you are so well read. For those of you who just watch TV like me, Tenzing Norgay was Sir Edmund Hillary's Sherpa. First two people to ever literally stand on the top of the world. And Hillary became an overnight celebrity. It's why you recognize his name and not so much Tenzing's. He was knighted by Queen Elizabeth. His name became known by every school child across the world, I think. And he could have lived in this just beautiful, successful life, right? But he didn't do that. Instead, he went back to Nepal, back to those Sherpas, all like Tenzing, who had grown up, who had lived to do just exactly what they do. A Sherpa is one who carries all of your gear. Can you imagine? Having somebody to just carry the weight of your load all the way up to 29,000 feet. Sir Edmund Hillary went back to that village, the village of Kumjung, the hometown of most of the Sherpas. And he found his friend and he said, what could he do for this area? And Tenzing said this, our children lack education. They're not prepared for the future. What we need more than anything is a school in our village. And so Hillary established the Himalayan Trust, and in 1961, a three-room schoolhouse was built in that village by the funds raised by Hillary. And since that time, that trust has built 27 schools, 2 hospitals, 12 medical clinics, numerous bridges, airfields, restored the forests and the valleys and the slopes in the areas of Nepal. Hillary didn't just hear, he listened. And so this morning, I'm wondering what it will look like for you to listen to the words of God. Because remember, listening is not just understanding. It's responding, it's going and doing. May we all listen to him. This morning, if you need to respond by having somebody pray with you, for you, in the back, our elders and their wives will be here. Or if you need to respond by being baptized into Christ, we would love for you to do that this morning. And we're going to sing a song and we're going to stand. And if you'd like to go to the back or come to the front, we'd love for you to do that right now.